part of the DOT.
Today, we're going to start with Senate Bill 253, insurance for prostate cancer testing. We hadn't heard the bill previously. We do have an amendment. Have we adopted amendment number one already? Yeah, okay. So amendment number one has been adopted. We have amendment number two by Senator Rieger. Senator Rieger.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move amendment number two, ask unanimous consent.
Okay, I would object for the purposes of an explanation, please.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I believe there was a consensus in the committee to investigate, and maybe a consensus to add the coverage for annual pap smear cancer screening tests to give some symmetry to the bill, which also talked about an annual prostate screening test. And I had my staff check with the American Cancer Society to get the recommended age bracket, and that's covered in the amendment. And we have checked with the prime sponsor's office, and they are supportive of the amendment.
Okay. Other questions, Senator Sharp?
Senator Rieger, did they give you any kind of estimate, like on the bottom of the fiscal note, to add to that?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have that with me, but I suppose that part of the response would be like the response to the original bill, that the upfront costs are kind of well known, but the costs or the benefits of the prevention are pretty difficult to quantify, but the theory is that probably overall it's a cost savings, but it's hard to really pin it down. But I didn't get an actual fiscal note on that.
Mr. Chairman, I really don't have a problem with it, but I would think something that is sort of has a unisex appeal would be glaucoma testing, which covers both males and females, and is a serious situation that would probably be, we want to add things. I think that would probably be a better return on the bucks for glaucoma pressure testing for everybody. But anyway, I won't propose that amendment this time. We'll see. I'll see what kind of fiscal attachment I get to that.
You're looking at that
one. Yeah, I'm looking at that one.
See, you can see you were clear.
Not me.
Okay. Any other questions on the amendment before we... are there objections to the amendment? Okay. If there are no objections, then amendment number two is adopted.
I thought you was kidding me. Nothing on it.
We have Gene Daw wishing to testify. Mr. Daw, did you testify before?
Yes, I did. It sounds like I don't need to testify, so okay. Thank you.
Right. Does anybody else wish to testify? Senator Phillips.
I just want to say he's observing the rules. When you have to vote, you vote. When you do, and when you don't, you talk.
So. Right. Okay, is there a motion from the committee? What's the pleasure of the committee?
Would it be a finance siesta?
Yes, it would be.
Okay, I would move that the Senate Bill 253 finance maybe it was a recommendation.
Okay, is there objection? No objection. The bill would move to the committee of individual recommendations to accompany the bill. Excuse me. Next on the schedule is SB 244. The calculation of state aid to education. Eddie, would you like to join us at the table? This bill we had heard before. I think there is some concern. I was working on a CS that would do a few things, including try to make it revenue neutral by increasing the deduct to 96%. From the 95 in the current version, making it effective in the 1996 year we're in, so that it could offset the supplemental funding that we had in the supplemental bill, and having a hold harmless for FY96 for those communities or school districts that would lose more than they gained in this fiscal year. And to take off the single site addition with the recognition that would most likely be dealt with in any future foundation formula change, we would do the single site as we have done it in previous years, within the budget process, but not as to the formula at this time. Those were the suggestions that I had made to myself, and I was hopeful that the committee would find those agreeable and acceptable as a compromise. I know that some members won't like, maybe no members will like everything in that compromise, but I see it as a way to potentially move forward. We don't have that draft in front of us as yet. I looked at one this morning and it wasn't correct, so with that, I'd like to just perhaps get some feedback from the department and other committee members to see if potentially supportable by the committee.
For the record, my name is Eddie Jeans, project assistant with the Department of Education. And Senator Frank, that would be acceptable to the Department of Education.
Okay. Senator Rieger?
Mr. Chairman, it kind of is in my memory, but I might be wrong on this, that the idea of not going to a 100% deduct was that there had to be some small residual to in order to induce a school district to apply for PL 874 monies. But as I was mulling that notion over, if I understand the formula correctly, what happens is that the formula results in an entitlement, and the entitlement is then minus what the PL 874 entitlement is. So, for example, if you're if the formula says you're due $100 and you have $20 of PL 874 money coming, that the formula only gives you 80, and then you get the other 20 from PL 874. But actually, they only deduct 90% of that, so you get 82 plus the 20. But I'm wondering if that inducement of that little residual percentage is necessary, because if you have a 100% deduct, you'd still have a compelling inducement to apply for the PL 874 monies, because you need that to bring yourself up to your full entitlement. And I wonder if that's a red herring to have to not hit the 100% deduct level.
Through the chair, Senator Rieger, the state of Alaska cannot require school districts to apply for impact aid funds. And the foundation program does utilize impact aid funds to determine a state allocation. So if school districts do not apply and receive impact aid funds, you have nothing to deduct to adjust state aid by.
Okay, if I can, are you saying that the formula does not deduct the entitlement, but deducts the actual receipt of the funds?
Through the chair, that would be correct, Senator Rieger.
And is that required? Why wouldn't the formula deduct the entitlement and leave it up to the school district to apply for? And not really care, you know, theoretically, whether they do or not, but of course they would.
Through the chair, Senator Rieger, the school districts that apply for impact aid funds under the impact aid law are actually entitled to a greater amount than they actually receive currently. The funding is based on an annual appropriation from Congress, which has been less than entitlement. So, and the foundation statute itself also clearly states that it's funds received in response to the application and not based on entitlement.
Mr. Chair, if I can continue. In the other dealings that we have with the federal government, in particular in the health and social services area, the federal government is real good at creating constructive receipt of funds, whether you apply for them or not. And that's why, for example, people cannot decline to apply for a permanent fund dividend or a longevity bonus in order to remain eligible for other assistance. And I think it's a very well-established principle in federal agencies that they constructively receive the funds whether they take them or not. And it's hard for me to imagine that they would not permit the same approach in PL 874 money. Just a thought. I mean, that would be a double standard if they apply it against the state in one case and not apply it in the other. That's all I have.
Further questions?
Senator Durham.
Yeah, thank you, Chairman. I guess this a part of the compromise there is to take out the amendment that relates to the single dual-site schools. Everything that we've heard up to this point, and everybody agrees that we're talking about these districts, they are non-funded out there, and we should be taking care of this as a problem. And we are working on restructuring the formula, but when that's going to happen, I don't know. If and when. And here again, we have in this bill the opportunity for the introduction of them. Well, I guess it is included in the bill that does take care of the single dual site schools. And I'm not going to go over all the arguments there as to why there's such a discrepancy on funding per student in these schools versus or other rural schools versus what it is in the larger urban areas. But we have an amendment here that everybody that's involved with this has finally come to an agreement on. And it's been supported by the State Board of Education, by the School Board of Administrators, and by the Association of School Boards, as well as NEA. And it seems like taking this part out of the bill is not only status quo, but it's still a step backwards because the school districts then have to come back in and fight for the funding to make their services equitable with everybody else's around the state. We're not talking about school districts that are flush with money. You know, I can point out to several that have cut back what I consider to be core programs. The frustration of having to deal with coming back to the legislature each year for the additional funding is just something we shouldn't be putting them through. I'm very disappointed there that this would be considered a compromise amendment to make everybody happy because I don't see it doing that.
Senator Frank.
Well, Senator, I appreciate your concern, and I feel like we're not going to get anywhere unless we do some kind of a compromise. And I acknowledge what you say. I would expect that the single site language would be in the budget, but I certainly acknowledge your concerns.
Further questions or comments?
Yeah, thank you, Chairman. One of the other members of the body that is not on the final committee has suggested an amendment for consideration, and it has to do with funds that are identified for preschoolers, and possibly the department can comment on it, because it's probably a little bit more familiar. With the situation that I'm in, with the impact aid and funds going to the school district, that districts apply and receive preschool funding, that should not be counted against them in any way. So this amendment would offer an exclusion in that area. So possibly the department can comment on this, and then if you're going to rewrite the bill, or if you're waiting for a draft that possibly if you're looking to spare to compromise, it's just tightly one thing that you wish to consider as well. I don't know what the intentions of the committee are. We're going to pass the bill out today, or we're going to review it.
I don't think we're capable of passing the bill out until we get that CS. So,
so then, Mr. Chairman, I would ask that the amendment be reviewed and considered for the CS as well.
Okay. And when the CS is before us, the amendment's also here.
Could we get the administration to find the opinion?
Have you seen this amendment?
Just briefly.
Could you give us the rundown on it?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chair, the impact aid law was amended in 1994, and in that amendment, there was a change that allows school districts to claim preschool children for impact aid funds. This amendment would have the state back those funds out before it considers the impact aid. This would be similar to the special ed add-on and the Indian lands add-on. The impact aid program currently does not address these preschool funds as incremental funds that the state cannot consider. As Senator Zaroff pointed out, the foundation program does not provide funds for preschool children, and I'm assuming that that would be the reason for this amendment.
This would have then the effect of reducing the state deduct in those districts that do have a preschool program and would qualify for those federal funds?
Through the chair, Senator Frank, that would be correct.
Okay, would you be able to quantify that for us? Not necessarily right now, but can you do that?
Through the chair, Senator Frank, currently the impact aid funds are being paid at a hold harmless level, a percentage of the 94 year. So even though that the school districts can actually claim these students, they're not actually receiving funding for them at this time. The department is aware of the issue and will be working with the U.S. Department of Education on how to address it.
So, Mr. Chairman, the new federal impact aid law is no longer called PL 874.
Through the chair, Senator Rieger, that's correct.
So we can't call it PL 874 anymore.
Through the chair, Senator Rieger, we shouldn't.
Okay, we have to learn a whole new. Now it's USC 7701 funds.
Actually, it's Title 8.
Oh.
Record, I'm Carl Rose, Executive Director of the Association of Alaska School Boards. I'm on record as supporting the Senate Bill 244. I am concerned about the discussion on the amendment, and we are very concerned about the single site issue being removed. To a large extent, many of those small school districts depend on single site funds to the tune of somewhere between 10% to 15% of their overall budget, and if it's left outside of the foundation, any kind of a decrease could affect them twice. Once through the foundation and the possibility of not receiving the additional funding through a supplemental. So we're very concerned about that. Secondly, the discussion of a 96% deduct, I'm not clear on what impact that has.
It just goes from 95 to, you're familiar with the bill as
yes,
introduced. Well, they were proposing going from 90 to 95. We're saying take it one more percentage point to 96 so that it's a revenue neutral, entirely revenue neutral, or closer yet to being revenue neutral.
That would be in terms of what is deducted?
Right. From the allowable side, you still can't deduct for special ed or for Indian lands, but it's, in other words, it just increases the deduct by one more percentage point.
Well, I understand now. All right. Basically, we're open for discussion on that. I know that the bill's not before you, but I was concerned and still remain very concerned over the single site issue.
Right. Okay.
Thank you for my comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, okay, the bill will remain in committee. We'll work on CS.
Yeah, I hope that you have that back. Maybe by tomorrow.
Subject of a lot of debate, and we discussed discussion as to what their effect would be on the same kind of federal funds that we lose if we do anything about railroads. And so the bill is before us, the bill is in the last of the confidentiality of this.
You know, it seems like we're being impeded forward motion, as I call it, based on federal funding. So have we, I think there's a point in time we have to discuss whether we tell the Fed to keep their money, thank you, but no thanks, and just use the runaway bill as an example and fund the $600,000 out of the general fund. I mean, that's a policy call. I frankly think people in Alaska will say go for it, considering all the fiscal problems we have. I think it's a worthy cause. I think at some point in time, we're just going to have to tell even the Fed, thanks, but no thanks. We'll do it our own way. And I'm at that point right now.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think, I absolutely agree. I think we should see if there, I think we need to understand better the federal situation, and we've asked the department to help us understand that better. If there's a way that we can meet our objective while still retaining the federal funds, that would be probably the best of both worlds. But I agree with you on the policy level that we shouldn't not have the kind of laws that we think are most effective in dealing with the problem just to save some federal funds. So I agree with you.
So I think at some point in time we've got to have that discussion, like soon. Because I've reached my threshold of tolerance now.
Right.
Hopefully the changes in Congress in the last year or so are going to wash through some changes in the kind of band-aids that caused the problem as well. I know they're considering that.
I just commented, I think from the area that I represent, and Senator Frank, we've got adjoining areas. I think that by far the most concern from my constituents is the confidentiality. They want to know who in the hell is a criminal living in their neighborhood. And it's real simple. That's it. They don't really care about anything else, but they want to make sure that that is not confidential.
Well, those are the provisions that were taken out of the bill by the judiciary.
Well, that's why I'm raising the point right now, because I'm not real thrilled about that.
I don't have any problem with adults.
We probably had a legal opinion, right? Some legal opinions saying we can't do this, can't do that.
The legal opinions and fiscal notes.
For the record, I'm Kelly Huber, staff to Senator Halford. And Senator, the department is here if you want to ask them specifically, but the old fiscal note to Senate Bill 270, which was the original version, which included the records provision, the total cost to the division if this bill passed is 7.625. That is the fiscal note that they distributed to the Judiciary Committee. That is from the Health and Social Services, Family and Youth Services. Based on that, the Judiciary Committee decided that they didn't want to get into that battle of losing the federal funds, which is what Senator Phillips is not too comfortable with. And so they deleted everything to deal with records in that committee.
Essentially got the bill.
Well, the bill has some
some provisions that help in terms of what the court might consider, rather than just a very nebulous statement of public interest and minors' interest. It does increase those things. It does help with municipal offenses. So it's a small step in the right direction. The problem is confidentiality is the thing that we can withdraw from violators that has the most immediate impact and the least cost in terms of cost to the state, except if the federal government really does that. And the other question is, do you believe the department that the federal government will do that? I don't know the answer.
Well, fine, yeah.
We didn't get this discussion here because of my nomination.
Well, that takes 7.5 million out of health insurance services to them, but easier said than done. But when you look at the priorities, I think this is a priority.
I agree. I would love to do it. Let's.
Anyway, I don't want to miss any part.
We have Kathy Smith here from DIYS. She can explain it to us, maybe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Kathy Tibbles with the Division of Family and Youth Services. With regard to the federal funding issue, we have repeatedly inquired and repeatedly been told that if information from our records or information that reaches the court or other agencies through our records is made public on a blanket basis, full disclosure, that we will be ineligible to apply for federal funds through Titles 4E and 4B, which comes to roughly $7.6 million. There are several states, well, most states actually, that do publish juvenile records. That publication is allowed because the juvenile delinquents are not in the same agency as the children in need of aid, which these provisions are basically set up for. We are in the process of looking at a restructuring of our division. We early had been told that as long as they were in our agency at all, that we would be we would suffer the financial penalties if we disclosed information. We now have indications that it would be possible for us to restructure organizationally, which would be at some cost administratively, but would not be the same kind of loss of $7.6 million. And so we are currently looking at how we could restructure to meet their approval so that we could disclose some degree of information with regard to juvenile delinquents. We recognize the community's concerns, we recognize the legislature's concerns, and we have also had some meetings of our key staff to discuss that and come up with it. There is a certain amount of information that we also believe is appropriate and would be good policy issues to be able to disclose. So we are, this is not an inflated fiscal note because we are in total opposition to even looking at disclosure, but we can't afford to provide any kind of services if we lose that degree of federal funding. Well, the governor's conference on juvenile justice is discussing this issue this week. We would like an opportunity to attempt to restructure and work out some kind of an agreement with the feds, if you'll excuse my abbreviation, rather than just jeopardizing our funding to that level.
Is the structural break between delinquent and child abuse, is that statutory or is that totally within the department?
It's within the department, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When a juvenile is waived into adult court, is the status of the record changed and then it is not subject to confidentiality?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rieger, waiver to adult court removes all juvenile constraints. All bets are off and they're treated as an adult.
Okay.
Senator Sharp?
Through the chair, we hear a lot about what the opinions have been and the information has been on as far as what the feds tell us we have to do. Could you provide that in writing? I mean, we're talking big bucks. Give it to us in black and white. Where the feds have told you that we would lose the funds if we did X, Y, Z. You know, anyone else that provides that information through Testimonies Act, ask and that kind of meaningful testimony is asked to prevent pretty hard evidence. And I have yet to see anything, as far as any opinions, that says, signed off by a federal agency or person, a real person, that says, you will lose your federal funds if you do this. So if you got that, why don't you give it to the committee when you get a chance?
I will. No, Senator Phillips, there is not.
I included in that, I'd like chapter and verse of what has to be changed at the federal level so we can get on to our Congress people back there to change it. You know, precisely what forbids us to do it and why they would reject our federal funding. So we know what the target, both here and in D.C.
Well, if it's another way to ask the same question, are there any federal constraints on release of juvenile delinquency records if they're not contained in the same stream as CIA records?
Mr. Chairman, I do not believe that there are. The issue is that section of our out-of-home care population would not be eligible for reimbursement for the foster care or residential care expenditures from the federal government as they are now, which is one reason that Alaska has continued to try to mesh the two so that we could maximize our federal receipts in foster care and residential care by including juvenile delinquents in that. That then places us in the position of not being able to release those records. We are trying to separate out the costs, which are difficult given that they're in the same BRU and a good share of the federal receipts are in administrative claims, not just the reimbursement for the foster care costs, but the administrative costs associated with serving the kids in social work positions and probation officer positions. And so it's difficult to determine how much we would lose not being eligible and not claiming for the juvenile delinquency part, but we are trying to come up with those figures so that we can present that information to you.
The fiscal notes that totaled that large amount of money were about a month ago. Is there some possibility of getting a fiscal note that would reflect the cost of the separation of child-related education and any of the administrative cost of doing that, number one? And number two, any potential loss of incidental federal funds that will result after that by making delinquent records available?
Mr. Chairman, we are working on trying to do that. I don't know whether I could get that to the committee before the end of the week. I should have asked before I came over this morning, but I did not anticipate this discussion.
Well, I think it's worth waiting. If we could make that work, I think, honestly, I don't want to see the bill die as we wait. But if there is some reasonable way within some legitimate cost constraints that we can make information available to the public, with the current effect of that, I think it's pretty significant. Compared to the other things we're doing, we're not making much progress. So I would suggest that we hold the bill and try and work with you to see if we can come back with some numbers that reflect the reorganization necessary to make it work and then possible.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. We do have one person on the teleconference that we'll hear from the Municipality of Anchorage, if you're still on there. Are you on, Mary Lou?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
I assume you've heard the discussion about the portions of the bill that aren't still there, but we're still hoping for. Your interest is in, I think, the portions of the bill that are still there.
Mr. Chairman, I'm having trouble hearing you.
Why don't you just go ahead with your testimony on the bill?
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. With respect to Senate Bill 270, my name is Mary Hughes. I'm a municipal attorney for the municipality of Anchorage. And the bill presented to the committee by Senators Halford, Green, and Phillips incorporates some of the municipal and the mayor's partnership plan, and we are supportive of the bill. And we have listened not only today but at other times to this morning discussion of the concerns with respect to the federal funding. We made our own inquiries some weeks ago with respect to that issue and found out that a departmental reorganization would solve the problem. So we were happy to hear Ms. Worley, or if it was Ms. Worley that testified today, because I came on late, her indication that that might be a resolution, because that's what we were told at the federal level, that obviously when you're dealing with juvenile delinquents, you have different rules and regulations than in children, than in the situation of children in need of aid. But this particular bill not only handles a jurisdictional concern that the municipality has, which we would like to see implemented, that is giving us jurisdiction over some minor civil juvenile infractions, but it also puts in a numbered sequence on page 4 of the bill some dispositional considerations that the court needs to make, not just what's in the best interest of the child, but also what's in the best interest of the public. It kind of mirrors the conditions of bail that you see on the adult criminal side. So we are very much in favor of that. With respect to the records and the entire issue of the juveniles and what can be released and can't be, what I'd like to, I guess I'm in favor of, as one of the senators indicated, holding and seeing what the department comes up with, because we are very much in favor of some type of release of information or some type of opening of hearings. And if the department can make some changes that would allow that to happen, that would be great. I had thought that that couldn't be done this session, but if it could, that would be wonderful. Mr. Chairman, other than that, I have no further comments.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there questions by committee members?
Did she?
Senator Phillips.
You said page 4, best interest of the public. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay. Could you go through that again?
Oh, I'm sorry, on page 4 of the bill, I'm hopeful I have the same bill you do, lines 1 through 18.
Right.
There's 7 iterations on disposition.
Okay.
And one of the concerns that we had was that under the law as it presently is written, the juvenile's interest take priority over the interest of the public, and read together, these particular provisions also protect the public, and that was my comment.
All right. Okay, thanks.
Thank you. We don't have anyone else to testify on this bill. We will await some help from the department, and we thank you in advance for your efforts to kind of come up with something that works. Senator Rieger, do you have
a thank you, the department.
We have a couple of questions.
Philosophically, does the department support the release of the names?
Senator Halford, Senator Phillips.
What about the fiscal philosophy?
To some extent, yes, we are concerned about a piecemeal approach that would release the names of all kids who committed or were alleged to have committed a delinquent act and then not be able to follow through later, and if the kid were the equivalent of acquitted in adult court, not be able to clear the juvenile's name. There are different levels. I mean, there are still a large number of youth who, in the process of growing up, make stupid mistakes and hopefully learn from those mistakes and don't reoffend. And I can't say that we are convinced yet that the release of those names would serve any really valid interest of the public or of the juvenile. I think most of us have done something silly growing up. But there definitely is a belief in the department that some information should be released one for the deterrent effect and two for the protection of the public. We haven't come to a final decision internally yet what that information is.
I don't think the legislature has either. I think there's a definite interest in much more information for significant criminal acts, and particularly 14 to 18 year olds. I think when you sort it out, people are probably still, childhood mistakes that's, throwing an egg at something, or these kinds of things, criminal mischief or something. I don't think anybody wants to hurt somebody's record with those kinds of minor childhood misdemeanors, but that's not what I'm talking about anymore.
Yes, I realize.
Senator, are you next?
There's a, in looking at that list of seven, when I was reading the bill earlier, the only clause that I think can be looked at two ways is the clause that says on number five, the clause or other members of society. And I understand the value of deterrence, but in generally, I think that the value of deterrence is in the potential sanction imposed on people who might be considering committing a crime. But I'm a little uneasy in how this is worded, that I think deterrence is couched in the idea of making an example of one person to beyond perhaps the gravity of the crime in order to have an effect on others. And I think you have to keep in mind the due process person by person of what happens there, and that one clause does give me some concern.
Senator,
I was also concerned about some of those sections there. Number seven, the state has the ability to take custody. Didn't we have some discussion before there as to whether you had facility to detain minors? That was
The previous discussion was on minors that hadn't done anything wrong. And that whole question of runaways. This discussion deals with minors who have been in some way judged to have done something. And it doesn't matter the degree of the question.
So we're assuming that you're going to have some areas for detention then?
Well, we do have some ability, very limited.
Right.
And too limited. To detain minors who do, in fact, break the law. That's what this is. Is there some way to amplify that in mind?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Jarov, the ability of the state to take custody and care for the child is, I believe, currently in the children's statutes, but this section of the statute does regard youth who have been adjudicated and would be in the custody, and the decision by the court would need to, I believe, take into consideration our ability to and take appropriate action with the kid, and that's the variety of resources available, from foster care to residential care to locked juvenile facilities. Or for that matter, with a delinquent who also had mental health issues with psychiatric facilities.
Further questions?
Yeah, I think so. Other than maybe just under what circumstances, as you said, that the department would, maybe we should write some of the names out under what what crimes are we consider saying, well, if we call that for anybody to know. I don't know where you draw that line.
Chairman Halford, Senator Jarov, it's a very difficult line to draw, but I guess one case in point would be a juvenile sex offender. You can see the advantage of people knowing that someone who's babysitting their children is a sex offender.
Chairman, that's pretty much a fair question. Where that line would be drawn, and probably don't have a whole list of crimes that go from the worst to the least or something.
We will await the department's help with this.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Well, let's go on to House Bill 335. This is an old friend.
We have
questions.
After we're finished with this, we'll be registered guys, huh? After we finish with this, we register guys.
Yeah, qualify for the test.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we have a draft dated, it's 327.
Perfect.
327.96.
They all never
forget. Utero.
Mm-hmm. They all never forget.
This draft has been gone through with House sponsor, the Department of Public Safety, the Department of Commerce. It has also had input from the Department of Labor and DNR. I would suggest that there are there's probably agreement on most of the provisions. There are areas where the constituency regulator is not happy from two directions. One, the group of the constituency would like to have more regulation and more protection from competition. The other group of the constituency would probably like to have less enforcement, less regulation, and less than is in this bill. The criminal provisions in this bill are probably stronger than virtually any other profession. Size of the fines and the ability to consider some conduct felony. And there are some concerns. If the committee members want to go through it,
one hot point.
Basically, the entry into the profession is primarily the same as it was under the old guide book. The profession is aligned with registered and master guides, and the effect of those two terms is the same in terms of powers. A master guide is just a senior registered guide. And there are assistant guides and class A assistant guides and transporters. And the regulatory structure for all of that is similar to the existing law. The entry provisions and experience requirements are similar to existing law, or the law that was sunsetted in the existing is a question, but to the prior law. The provisions on the powers and duties are generally transferred to the department from the previous board, with some exceptions. There are some very strong provisions. As I say, the penalties for violation can be as high as $30,000. And that comes out of existing law. And there's a lot of objections to penalties that are high inside of the profession. That's a question that you may want to look at. There are, in the correspondence I've got, there are questions about the ability to use administrative sanctions, and there's a proposal, I think, from a group of guides in Fairbanks that limits administrative sanctions to no more than whatever the court did and of no longer duration than what the court did, and that may be a legitimate amendment. There are two areas, one that the Department of Labor is not particularly supportive. It's not that significant. It is the exemption from wage and hour for the first 60 days in any calendar year of employment of somebody licensed by somebody else licensed. Basically, it's assistant guides who are assigned in remote locations, not under the direct
hour-by-hour supervision of anyone, and it's far less an exemption from wage and hour than the very large ones that exist in a long list in the law. I'm looking for that section. That's a short section that just adds to the list of exemptions in wage and hour. The other area that there is disagreement by at least one portion of state government, and there's strong support by, I think, both sides of the, or most of the, those involved in the industry, is the DNR, or the other entity requirement. The old law required that anyone operating had to get landowner permission from state agencies, federal agencies, or private entities. The law still says you have to have permission, but now, because the areas are simply registration areas for public safety, any enforcement of those provisions has to be carried out by the agency itself. I mean, DNR is here and will tell you they don't like that provision. The problem is that the only ones that ever saw any enforcement in the past were guides. If there's an automatic way to enforce that provision against guides, and yet fishing guides and every other operator on state land didn't really have any enforcement, the guides felt that that was an unfair operation with regard to their activities.
You were looking for that section, section 10, Department
section
of Labor.
Section 10 is page the Department
20.
Of Labor section?
Right, page 20.
Right, okay, that's one that's out there. Let's go ahead and hear from, that's Department of Labor. Let's hear from DNR, Jane Abbott is here, why don't you go ahead and join us. You can characterize DNR's position probably better than I can.
Thanks, Senator. For the record, my name is Jane Anvik, and I'm the Director of the Division of Lands, and I'm here to testify briefly on the bill that you have before you this morning. The Division of Lands is concerned about the sections of the bill that eliminated the requirement that guides furnish proof of prior authorization to use state lands where the hunt will occur. Based on our past experience, we believe that if it is not required as part of their license, it's highly likely that the commercial guides will not seek a state land use permit for the short-term use of their camps. Under existing state law and state statutes, temporary uses of recreational uses for under 14 days is allowed, but if it's longer than that, then we require that they get a land use permit. While it's true that Title 38, the DNR titles, provide that the division with the authority to require land use permits for all commercial uses, it does not provide an incentive for people to come and secure a permit, nor does it provide the division with any enforcement capability against those who fail to secure a permit. Under Title 38, when the identity of an individual who's in trespass is known, the division's only recourse is to take the individual to civil court. The division does not have the authority to issue citations with financial penalties, as does the Department of Fish and Game or the Division of Parks. The most significant management issue for us is the ability to identify individuals who have left garbage and solid waste on lands which have been used. I have some photographs to share with the committee today that depict several different kinds of camps and problems. If they want to just sort of peruse them.
What page are we on?
We've been left off.
Okay.
We used to have a page.
Okay.
We went away. The issue really is that by adding a provision that says that if you want to have a license, you have to demonstrate that you have proof to enter state lands. It is the only carrot that we have to encourage people to do that. The pictures that you have seen there are different examples of places where people have trespassed. We've had to go out and clean it up. In some cases, to the extent of $8,000 or $10,000 to clean up the lands that we were not able to identify who had trashed them. We respectfully request that you would amend the section of the bill that would require proof of prior authorization to use state lands. Senator Halford has been very open in his discussion about the bill, and we appreciated that opportunity. It is clear that guides are identified as the commercial use in this bill that we would like to be able to require that, and we simply don't have that kind of authorization for other commercial uses. We believe that providing prior authorization would give us better capability to manage the lands. The regulations went into effect in 1993. We had a 75% increase in people who came to secure permission to use state lands since these regulations went into effect. We would expect that there would be a 75% decline in people who would be likely to come in and secure state lands, state permits, if this provision goes away. On the average, we have about 350 licenses. They cost about $350. We have raised $132,000 through the provisions of this bill, and we would expect to have a significant decline in revenue as a result of that.
Senator Phillips. What's the opposite argument? Why was it dropped? Let me get straight. 14 days, use it. Less than 14 days, you don't need a permit. You've got to notify the department that you're using.
Correct.
Beyond that, you've got to get a permit.
Correct.
And that was dropped.
No, that's still the law in Title 38. What this says is that if you are a guide using state land, you have to demonstrate that you got that piece of paper.
Okay. So what's wrong with that?
You have to prove in advance through the cost of your guide license that you are the only class that is following a DNR regulation, which they can otherwise enforce. Remember that you have to, in order to guide, you have to notify the Department of Public Safety, or actually it's Commerce again, exactly where, in a fairly small geographic area, these guide units are much smaller than game management units or subunits. So you have to notify exactly which one of those that you're operating in. DNR can take that information and go after you if you leave a mess. But the provision that applies only to guides, not to surveyors, not to fish guides, not to any other operators, was that in order to get your guide license, you had to prove that you had asked them in advance. And it was for state agencies, federal agencies, it was a proof of prior approval by specific location. And that was a bureaucratic nightmare that only applied to the guiding industry, didn't apply to anyone else. And the majority of their enforcement and income came from the guiding industry because it was tied to their own license provisions. And basically it was felt to be very unfair that industry and not all their competitors in like industries, everything from ecotourism to fishery operations.
I agree with you. So can we apply that to all of them? In this bill?
Not a license provision.
And this stuff right here doesn't surprise me. I've seen it before.
I would suggest that if that had been guides, they wouldn't have been able to pin it on them because, in fact, they're too closely tied to a specific area. You'll only have about 4 or 5 people to check on in a given guide use area to know who to go after. That is probably the activity of air taxis and transporters. I shouldn't even say that it's necessarily a professional activity. Maybe the activity just the pure individuals and the people who provide the transportation may have not had anything to do with it or any knowledge of it. But it's a core provision of the bill that the old pre-registration and its multitude of requirements are not contained. And the registration in this bill is an enforcement tool, not an economic regulation tool. It says that you have to notify the department where you're going to be 30 days before you intend to be there. And that notification lasts through that year. So you're stuck with those notifications for the year. It's a compromise between the very, very restrictive old guide use areas and the I think, majority of the profession who would like to not have those areas at all. And it still provides, I think, some help to the department in being able to tie down who was there if they do have a mess. So it's not an automatic permit selling mechanism. Because remember, the people that end up buying the permits are not necessarily the people making the mess. They're probably not the people making the mess because they know that they're going to certainly get in trouble for it. So what you've got is a permit in DNR that applies to all commercial users of all state land, only being enforced against one particular group.
Why not enforce it all?
This bill would provide it to be connected directly to the license,
right.
And we don't have that kind of a carrot with other commercial users. So the solution was to remove this carrot with this group of users.
They want to get involved.
I don't know if we have anyone from the Department of Labor here. I can just tell you that the Department of Labor expressed their objection to any change in any exemption to raising hell. They don't think this one is that significant, but they object to it as a matter of course, as they do to any exemption to raising hell. We do have a couple people on teleconference, and these are people that we've got that had some specific proposals from. I'd kind of like to hear from them and let them go through what their suggestions are. Do we have Wayne Woods on the teleconference? Hello?
Yes, we're here at Natsu. Go ahead.
Wayne Woods?
Yes. Good morning, Chairman and members of the committee. We had some proposed changes. There are a number of the Natsu area guys here that had looked over this work draft and have come up with some proposed changes that we would like to see. We'll go ahead and start out on page 4, line 10.
I'll bring it up.
We would like to delete the current language in A and replace it with a major violation of a state hunting, guiding, or transportation services statute or regulation within the last 5 years.
Okay, wait a minute. We're at page 4, line 10.
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay, that's a... Okay, go ahead, on to the next one. That is, I think, not very much different than the effect. How much are you proposing to delete? All of line 10 through what?
Page 4.
Yeah, basically all of Section A in that. And later on we go on in definition to define what major violation would be.
Okay, go ahead. Go ahead with your next suggestion.
Okay, next would be page 6, line 16.
Page.
We would like to delete 18 and insert 21.
Why is that?
Well, basically, we aren't comfortable with the Class A assistant guide licensing provisions set forth in Section B of this. We're not comfortable with the fact that someone that doesn't have any experience in the guiding profession be granted a Class A assistant guide and giving them control over a guide to camp.
He's talking about the AG. It's page 6, line 16.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, okay. Page 6, this is regarding the same section. Page 6, line 22 and 23, we would strike in the game management unit for which the license is sought.
Okay.
And page 6, line 27, all of Section B, we would delete.
Okay, you need to know just as a matter of policy, that section is, I mean, the 18 to 21 is probably an open question, but as a matter of policy, the whole question of Class A assistant guides and how rural residents can get access to the profession a little bit more easily, I think is a policy call that there's a lot of interest in maintaining pretty much as agreed.
Yeah, well, it's just as a Matt Sue here, after discussing it at length, we personally didn't feel comfortable with hiring someone to represent us that had no experience in the guiding profession and therefore didn't have any experience per se with the regulations that we're forced to work under.
That's understandable. The next area.
Okay,
some of the rural guys might have problems with that.
Well, it sounds like we'll go to the next one here. Okay, page 10, line 23. We wanted to delete section 2, and our justification for this was this section allows for abuse within the bureaucracy due to the subjective nature of the statute.
Okay, go ahead.
Yes, page 10, line 25. We felt we could delete section 3 because this is adequately covered under the license renewal section.
Okay.
Okay, I'd like to backtrack a little bit and go to page 10. Line 11, we would add the following language. After $100,000, insert, in the case of registered guides, proof of financial responsibility shall only be required when applying for a guide use area.
Okay, I think What you're trying to say is a registered guide working for somebody else shouldn't be required to prove financial responsibility.
And that's entirely correct.
I think that's the intent of the way the bill reads, but we need to check that with the department to make sure that's so.
Okay. The next thing that we would like to see is on page 11.
Okay.
On line 31, we'd like to add a new section to read section 1. The department shall act on disciplinary matters in a timely manner, and the department may only impose disciplinary actions that are no greater than those imposed by a court of competent jurisdiction, nor may the department impose any disciplinary action that extends beyond the limits of a judgment of conviction imposed by a court of competent jurisdiction.
Okay.
Okay, page 12, line 2. We would like to replace 20 with 30 between then and days.
Okay, just so you know, the original draft had 30. That was a compromise back for public safety wanted 10 days. That number came in as a compromise between the advocacy of public safety and what was originally proposed as 30 days. Continue.
Hey, we'll go on to page 15. And On line two, we'd like to replace is with may be held. And on line four, page 15, we'd like to insert after guide, if there is a demonstrable complicity shown.
Okay.
And then page 15, line 8, insert after transporter if there is demonstrable complicity shown.
Okay.
Then on to the definition section. With these provisions, we feel like we could work very well within this set of regulations.
Now, all three of you have sent similar requests. So does your testimony cover the same issues with the three of you that are there at the LIO?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. We thank you very much for your testimony.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Jarrett.
Just a question here. On page 15, I think it was lines 14, I think 8, you were inserting the phrase demonstrably complicity.
If there is demonstrable complicity shown.
What does that mean?
The question is the section where guys are responsible for the violations of their employees. And the statute and standard is very high now. Essentially, if an assistant guy does something, the guy's responsible whether he was there, whether he knew about it, could do anything about it or not. And it still gets determined through the court system, so it's not that absolute. But it's a very high standard of control and complicity. What I think they're requesting is that standard be a little bit more reasonable on its face, so that it says the guy may be held responsible for the violation of someone else if there is demonstrable complicity shown. I don't know that that's legalese, but I think it's fairly straightforward. It means that if they knew about it and were a part of it.
Is it something that's measurable then? Or can you actually prove that?
I don't know. And I think public safety would argue that the requirement to show complicity might let somebody off who in some way knew that this was going to occur and was not, you couldn't really prove it. I don't know. We have the deputy commissioner of the department here. Can you give us any ideas?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Jeff Bush, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Commerce and Economic Development. When the previous speaker was testifying, I actually made a note in the margin of that I had the same question that Senator Zaroff was raising, that I don't know if there's a legal standard known as demonstrable complicity. I should point out that all the criminal provisions, as I read them in this bill, require knowledge or knowing violations. So in terms of criminal violations, you would have to know that there was criminal activity or illegal violations going on. So therefore, from that perspective, I would assume knowledge would constitute what we're talking about as demonstrable complicity. So then the only question remains on the civil or administrative side. As a suggestion, I know that there's a legal standard of knowing knew or should have known of the violations or something of that sort. That's a very common
knew or
thing.
Should have known?
If the registered guy knew or should have known of the violation or something of that sort.
I think that's a better language if it's already defined. Thank you. Does the department have any suggestions, position?
Mr. Chairman, as the department's on record as essentially supporting this piece of legislation, we've raised the concerns raised by the other departments. We support the work that's been done in general. I would say that our concerns have been met. So I think that's without going through the details page by page, which I'm not even in a position to do today. I can tell you that we feel comfortable with it.
Senator Rieger had to go see the Russians, but he wanted me to point out a few things, so if you want to make notes here. Page 4, lines 9 through 15, he has a note that states this.
Page 4, lines 9 through 15.
Right.
Okay.
And with a note, still this is an all or nothing proposition. That's just a comment there. Page 15, line 8. Yes.
Page 15, line 8.
Okay. The word for should be of.
You're right.
Page 16, between lines 30 and 31, add double fees for non-residents. Page 16 again, between lines 30 and 31, add double fees for non-residents. And that is his concerns or suggestions for.
What was the other one where you said double fees?
Okay, that's on page 16, lines 30. Between 30 and 34, you have to add a new E to it to say double fees for non-residents.
Right, got that.
Okay. Which one are you?
The second with reference to that.
Oh, I think I'd ask where that was located.
Oh. I think that was.
Okay. There was discussion of that, and I certainly don't have any objection to doing that. What's the department's? What would the department's position be on requiring doubling or tripling those fees for non-residents?
Mr. Chairman, we've had extensive discussions on this proposal with the Department of Law. The position from a policy perspective is we support the concept. The position from the department's perspective is it would probably be unconstitutional from the Department of Law's perspective. And the reason being,
commercial fishing licenses.
The reason being that we, in essence, the way that I understand it, at least from a layman's perspective, is that the courts allow an agency to charge essentially full cost of an activity, of a licensed activity, to a non-resident, and allow the state to essentially subsidize residents. But in the case of this occupational license, there would not be, the entire amount is paid by the licensees. There is no state subsidy.
But doesn't it cost money to have law enforcement? Doesn't it cost money to have DNR? Doesn't it cost money to have all the management that doesn't come through this license?
That would obviously be the argument.
I mean, there's a common property resource at stake. There's all other facets of state government utilized by the same licensees. All that the license covers is the direct cost of licensing, basically.
Mr. Chairman, I don't really feel too competent to answer your questions because I'm not the expert on this. I'm just trying to give you the argument as best I understand it from the Department of Law.
Well, I think most people in the profession would like to see a differential between resident and non-resident. We went through this back and forth about three different times, and if we can do it, I think we want to do it. The question of whether we can or not, that's about. Because it requires a hunting license. In fact, there is a higher fee for a non-resident because they have to buy a non-resident hunting license if they are a guide who's not a full-time resident of the state. But that's the only differential that's in there now. Don't disagree, Senator Jarrah.
We had asked legislative research to ask that questionnaire some of the states, and they surveyed 10 western states and said 6 western states, including Alaska, charged the same to licensed residents as non-resident big game guides. 2 states, Utah and Washington, do not license big game guides. 2 states, Arizona and Oregon, charge different rates to licensed residents and non-resident residents. Arizona, if you're a resident, will cost you $100, a non-resident, $500. Oregon requires registration, not licensure, for outfitters and guides. Resident outfitters and guides pay a flat $50 registration fee. Non-residents pay according to similar fees in their own states. So if we charge a non-resident fee twice as much,
five times,
that Oregon would then charge an Alaskan there that wanted to get a license there the same amount that we would charge a non-resident here. If it was just the same, it would be the same.
Well, I would love to do it. I'll put in the bill whatever the Department of Law will tell us works within the bounds of the committee's desire. I mean, what do we want to see drafted in here? We've been through this question about 4 circles. No, opposes the differential. It's severable, and I suppose that if we put a 3-to-1 differential in there, or 2-to-1 differential in there, and it's lost, you have possibly a repayment. There's not very many people involved. It's not a great risk.
If I might, Mr. Chairman, you have, in fact, stated exactly the concern the Department of Commerce has, and that is only that we are required by statute to fully pay for the Occupational Licensing Administration through our fees. Obviously, if we have a differential rate, we're gonna end up with a total that's what we need. And then if the court requires some sort of a refund, we would hope that if we were to, for some reason, lose, that we would hope that somehow that's covered, presumably through other means. We don't have a problem adjusting our fees as necessary for as an ongoing basis. It's only the refund that would be a concern.
What are the wishes of the committee? What do you want to do? It sounds like Senator Rieger would like to have.
Yeah, he does, because it's real obvious.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think there ought to be a distinction between residents and non-residents. So what level that you pick, I think, is kind of arbitrary.
Well, I think it is justified based on all the other services, because the licensing fee is only covering the licensing, that function directly. It doesn't cover all the other services.
But I agree. There's a lot of management of that resource.
Do you want to be two times, three times? What do you want to be?
Like Arizona. No. I like to do it like Arizona.
Well, let's come back to a law question. What is it in commercial fisheries? Do you know?
For the record, my name is Beth Fertula with the Department of Law. I think it's 3-to-1. Just for the committee's information, Steve White has a case on appeal right now in the Carlson case, and it's a fee differential and limited entries, and it's 3-to-1. And just as the senators have been saying, the question will be whether or not you have costs to non-residents that you don't have for residents. So it's obvious that there are more costs. If you can quantify that, then you're going to make your record for why you're doing a fee differential. But it's a pretty bitter battle over 3-to-1 right now in limited entry, so you may want to take that into consideration. If you find out your costs from your agencies is what it's going to